It is Tuesday, January 1st, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Happy New Year. On this first day of 2013, we have one of our book club editions of the program. We talk to authors about their latest books. In a moment, Kevin Phillips, a familiar voice to public radio listeners. For years, he was a commentator on Morning Edition, as well as other NPR news magazine programs. He's written for Harper's, Times, and the Los Angeles Times, and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 for his book, The Cousins' War. His latest book, Years in the Making, is titled 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. And later on this edition of Ozarks, John Holmans, the executive editor of New York Magazine. He'll discuss his newest book, his first full-length book, actually, What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. And then still later, from Arkansas, Dr. Matthew Pate talks about his new book about the use of pain by cultures and governments around the planet as punishment. It's titled Corporal Punishment Around the World. That and more ahead on this book club edition of Ozarks at Large for January 1st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. There is a tendency to catalog events by single years. Mention 1929, and most of us will instantly think of the stock market crash and the resulting depression. 1776, of course, has its own place in American history, the revolution that led to independence. Historians will correct that myopic view of the past, though. The crash of 29 or the signing of the Declaration of Independence did not happen as spontaneous events. There is a trail leading to Wall Street and Philadelphia. It's the road to independence that Kevin Phillips examined in his new book, 1775, A Good Year for Revolution, a wonderful book that layers the developments that become American independence. Kevin Phillips is with me on the phone. Welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Happy to be here.
When most of us consider the Revolution, we do think of that mythical year, 1776. But 1775, as you point, had so many occurrences, large, small, political, military, that leads us to this revolutionary atmosphere. And many of those are events that we do not learn about, are they?
That's the thing. As I was working on this, I found myself with a kind of chronological backward creep going on. I would see that it wasn't just May or June of 1775, it was edging back towards 1774. The thing is, the whole notion of 1776 as being the critical year is largely predicated on July 4th and the role of the Declaration of Independence. And as you get beyond that, as you push that myth, that exaggeration aside, you begin to see that the revolution had about a year and a half, even more than that, before the Declaration of Independence, in which it was gestating.
When I read 1775, the thing that amazed me the most is that these colonies ever could coalesce. There are so many issues between what passed for urban then and rural, and just the story of how they have to come together in that era is fascinating.
Well, it's a complicated one because you have to look at regional differences. New England was pretty strongly for the revolution. The plantation colonies from Maryland down to the Carolinas were reasonably strongly for the revolution. The middle colonies, particularly New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, were very ambivalent. They could see that perhaps if all went well a century later, the British Empire might have its seat of ruling power and influence in New York or Philadelphia. The others could not see anything like that. So from the standpoint of New England and the plantation colonies, They were beginning to move that way in 1774. They moved strongly in 1775. They really had to push the middle colonies. And that's the second story. It wasn't enough that two-thirds of the colonies were pretty strongly in motion by mid-1775. They still had to take some fence-sitters and push them off the fence.
It's such an obvious observation to say that things were so different, the lack of the instant communication that we know now. But when you just examine the populations in 1775, the urban centers of this, of the colonies, maybe 35,000 people in Philadelphia, 25,000 in New York, your book really lets us know that these were such different times. And sometimes we forget that, I think.
We forget it because, of course, we have no sense of what it would have been like to be in the 13 colonies when their total population added up to about 2.7 million. But having said that, if you look at Europe, the 2.7 million in the colonies was bigger than the population in Switzerland, in Holland, I would think in Denmark, not too far behind that of Prussia. You were looking at colonies that had become a focal point of Europe. People in Europe thought that the reason the British had become such a power was partly because of these colonies and their resources and their just massively growing population. So although it was small by our present yardsticks in the context of what people in Europe thought and what people in America were starting to think, it was a fast-growing area with the potential to change the balance of world power.
And as you mentioned, the revolution, you can go to 1775, 1774, but as you point out, really, you can see seeds of certain events developing decades even before that.
Well, that's true. There are some people that have looked back and they've seen the psychological watershed developing in the 13 colonies in 1763 and 1764. When the British, who had just finished what we call the French and Indian War, what was called the 7 Years' War in Europe, at that point in time, the British were beginning to think they had to do something to put the colonies in their place. They were getting too big. Population wanted to move west of the Appalachians. Their maritime sector was too strong. It was giving competition to the British. They wanted to manufacture things in the 13 colonies that Britain wanted to ship there in a colonial system. So they started leaning, and part of how they leaned was to talk about taxes. Other ways in which the problem was becoming acute was not letting people or steering them away from going to the important colonies and trying to push them in the direction of maritime provinces of Canada and down into Florida. They just didn't like what was taking shape. And people in the colonies sensed this in 1763 and 1764, and attitudes were really beginning to change. No longer was the mother country the affectionately regarded power of yesteryear. It was starting to be a bit of a threat.
I think the book is worth picking up just for the 21st chapter alone, which discusses the invasion of Canada, which has long been popularly, I think, believed to be this sort of misstep in the whole process.
Well, that's right. And that's, again, part of the 1776 focus. Because if you're a historian or a reader and you're focused on 1776 and the whole 4th of July is the pivot of everything, the first thing you see with Canada is that the American troops are straggling back in the spring of 1776. They've lost the battle to capture the citadel of Quebec, and they've been squeezed out of Canada. But if you go back and you look at what was happening in 1774, but in this case, especially in 1775, you're looking at an invasion that almost succeeded. There were Indian leaders, Canadian tribal chieftains, who actually visited Washington and his camp outside of Boston in 1775 and said that they would be with the Americans if they invaded Quebec, as Canada was principally at that point. Another reason why Washington wanted to invade was to get the cannon from the Citadel of Quebec that he could use to force the British out of Boston. And again, the British were petrified. There are a number of communications, and these are well known by historians, that show that people in Quebec City in November and even early December were afraid that it was bound to fall. The Americans would take it over. Now, as long as the British were worried about losing Canada, it kept the pressure off Washington and all the troops in Massachusetts that were besieging Boston. So it was an integral part of a colonial strategy, basically to push the British north into Canada for the center of their preoccupation and to encircle them in Boston where they were trapped. And this was a disaster for British planners, but historians who don't go back and look at it from the dimension of what was being done in 1775 that had so much promise in Canada just don't get it at all.
And one last, perhaps really unfair question, more general, how long before a historian can get a firm grasp of an era? I mean, there are already books and lengthy articles dissecting a presidential election that's not yet 2 months old. Is there a certain amount of time that a historian needs to get a broader, fuller picture?
Well, I would say in this case there really is, because the whole thing has been so tilted to 1776 that even historians who specialize in the Revolution tend not to know very much about all these things that added up to an entirely different revolution if you just look at them from a perspective of 1775 and 1774. You have to get to the point where you're thinking sort of across the board with a whole spectrum of things, with each of the colonies, with what the British were doing, with what Congress was doing. And since it hasn't been a focus, it really takes quite a while. I would say I was in my third year of concentrating on this before I could begin to have a sort of view. Well, this is the third week in May of 1775. What was happening where? What were the British doing? What were the Americans doing? What was happening in the different provinces? Up until that point, you sort of share in the disjointed view of not much going on. And it comes hard to see all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but to see it accumulating in a way that you haven't seen it before.
You have to be immersed, it sounds like.
Yes, in a nutshell. Immersion is necessary.
Kevin Phillips' book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you for talking with me.
Ahead on this book club edition of a January 1st Ozarks at Large, John Holmans. He's the executive director of New York Magazine, and his first nonfiction book is titled What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. It's just been published, and we'll talk to him in just a few minutes. And later, Dr. William Pate, an Arkansas native, talks about the use of corporal punishment around the world. Those conversations and more ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Mother Nature herself has become a permanent fixture at Hobbs State Park Conservation Area in Benton County. Every second Saturday and second Wednesday of the month, she visits the park to excite the imaginations of all the children around her by reading stories of the forest and the animals that live there. Reading dates this month are Wednesday the 9th and Saturday the 12th. Mother Nature will begin 2013 with stories about our Northwest Arkansas animals that hibernate. For more information, 789-5000. And the Intervention Sciences Laboratory is looking for adults, those people 21 and over, who have experienced a traumatic life event and who currently drink alcohol. This study involves two visits to the laboratory that will involve a number of tasks, including completing two interviews with a researcher and a guided imagery task. Eligible participants will be compensated. If you're interested in participating or learning more about the study, you can contact Sarah Bajarski at 575-5811. This is Ozarks at Large.
At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the day's news. We interview actors, musicians, and artists of all stripes and take the time to understand what really drives them. We learn the story behind the story to get at the deeper truths that connect us all. I'm Melissa Block. Stop by for your daily dose of discovery every afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 3 until 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Happy New Year's.